Welcome back to the Outdoor Adventures Podcast. Today in the studio, I have Stacy Wise Schoenborn.
Enough.
See, we talked through it and I still messed it up. I wrote it down phonetically and I still
it's
messed it up.
It's a really hard name.
Okay, I'm going to try it again. Stacy Wise Schoenborn.
Born.
Why do I think it's because I've been saying it wrong for so many years.
It's okay. Everybody says it wrong. Yeah. You could just say WS because that's what a lot of people do.
Yeah.
Or the hyphenator.
I just call you Stacy.
That's fine.
That's just easier.
It's okay.
But I'll tell you, this lady, I've known her for I don't know how long, but she's just one of those people that is just always fun to hang out with. She's always got a smile on her face. She brightens up her room. She is the CEO of Central Willamette Credit Union, which is one of our local community credit unions. And she's very humble, but she does a lot of big things over there. And I mean, you guys are a pretty big entity.
Yeah, well, we've grown through the years. Actually, it's our 70th anniversary this year. Isn't that cool? We're one of the oldest, well, we are the oldest chartered financial institution in Linn County. Mm. So 70 years, and we started, well, everybody can do the math. And we were formed by federal workers and metals, and that's why before we changed our name to Central Willamette, we were Fed Metals, and we have a lot of members. We have 37,000 members and $600 million in assets.
Wow.
10 full-service branches. And so, yeah, I think it's great that we're in the community. We're really focused on giving back as much as possible and making our community that we live in a better place to live, work, and play. And I really feel it's important, if I may, try to keep your money local, because then the financial institution, whether it be Central Willamette or another local financial institution, not someone that's shipping your money out of state to leverage for whatever purpose, by keeping it local, we're able to do more with that money and donate and do sponsorships and things along those lines, because we're not for profit for a financial cooperative. So basically we're the Bi-Mart of financial services. And so the cool thing is we're keeping it local and we can do more. So
yeah,
do more good locally.
You guys give back a lot to the schools and to, I mean, I always hit Stacy up whenever I need a gift basket or something. She always comes
through.
Maybe
we shouldn't be putting this out there, Sam, because my marketing team will be like, holy smokes.
Well, sometimes you tell me you can't do it for whatever reason, but I mean, they're very generous to the community, and my parents have been there for years because my dad was a federal, he was a metals worker.
Metals worker, yeah.
So back like when ATI. It was Federal Metals
yep.
Credit Union, that's when they started. And I mean, he was with ATI for like 40 years before he retired.
Right. So that's great. Well,
when did
thank
you
him
start
for
there?
His business? Actually, in 2015. So it's my 10th year anniversary.
Congrats.
For being president.
And that's
CEO.
Probably about how long I've known you.
Probably because I joined Rotary right around there. Mm-hmm. And now, yes, still highly involved in the community because I think it's important to give back. Mm-hmm. I kind of have a service heart. And so I'm one of those folks that says, if you're going to complain about it, you better be doing something about it. Because if you're just going to complain, it really doesn't make a difference. It doesn't change anything. Mm-hmm. I guess you feel better for complaining for those few seconds, but it's not really done anything. So you got to take action.
Well, I'll tell you, you do take action. And I would say just from the outside looking in, one of the things I admire about you is you are willing to roll up your sleeves and get dirty. Like there's no job too big or too small for you to be willing to tackle when it comes. And I've worked with you on service projects through Rotary and seen that in action. And I know you do that in your daily work life too. So,
yes, I don't think it's not important, your title, really. It's about If you see something that needs to be done, do it. It doesn't, we all have to contribute. We all have to come together. We all have to just take on roles. So if the garbage needs to be taken out, take it out. Mm-hmm. In fact, my team always kind of cracks up because I'm a recycling freak. And so I'll dig through the garbage after big meetings because people put their cans in the wrong.
And we get 10 cents out here in Oregon, you know, that's
heck
big
yeah.
money.
You got to save those. I love my little green bags. I take them to Bottle Drop and I'm like, hey, because it adds up eventually. But I think it's just important. I'm like, hey, that can is in the wrong can. You know, one's blue and one's black. for a purpose. Yeah. One says recycle and one says garbage. So I'll just pick them up and move them out.
Well, it's amazing. You go to another place that doesn't recycle like we do in Oregon. Ugh. And it's very like, whoa, you're throwing all that in the garbage? I know. What are you doing?
Where do you think it goes?
Who knows?
Speaking of, we're talking about being outdoors. We need to preserve our outdoors as much as possible. So
yeah, exactly. I just watched a show on Amazon last night called Common Ground. Mm-hmm. And it's about regenerative farming.
Oh, cool.
And showing like old school farming versus new school farming. And they make it seem so simple when you watch it. You know, obviously it's swayed towards one opinion or whatever,
right.
But it's not a partisan issue trying to keep the earth a cleaner and healthier place.
Right. Exactly. You know?
I mean, that's something we should all care about.
I totally agree. I don't have any children, so, but lots of my friends do and my relatives do. I sometimes feel like, holy smokes, I don't want to be part of the problem. I want to be part of the solutions as much as possible and make sure that, you know, clearly I'm going to tap out. I'm gone eventually. And so how have I contributed to making the earth a little bit of a better place in general, which goes back to kind of the service heart. Like I want to leave this place a better place than when I found it as much as possible.
Yeah. Well, that's
within
great.
My control.
Right. Yeah. There's so many variables to that. We could spend a whole podcast talking about that.
We could.
But so Outdoor Adventures podcast, we typically talk about things outdoor related, but I've been after Stacy for a while because...
A long while.
Yeah, I've been harassing her to get her in here, and she's a busy lady. She's got board meetings, she's got things to do, she's got a meeting tonight after this, and so I appreciate you taking the time, and you know, what first piqued my interest was you did a presentation to Rotary when you had climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, and I was taken back by the fact that you did it and just, I wouldn't have thought, okay, when
you
I look
at- You would have bet against me?
Not against you, no, because I know you're very capable, but I would have looked at you and said, I don't see you as a mountain climber. Like that wouldn't have been like my first thing that I would have thought you would do. So before we dive into that a little bit, I wanted to hear more about your childhood and where you grew up and if you were doing outdoor things as you were growing up or what kind of drew you to the outdoor space.
Mm. Yes. So I'm an Oregon native and I grew up in East Multnomah County.
Okay.
Good old Troutdale. If you've heard of Troutdale, Oregon, mm-hmm. usually it's the exit that gets blocked when there's so much ice down the gorge and all the truckers have to stop there because they there's a gate that they close it off on 84 and you can't go any further.
So no driving in the ice.
No driving in the ice. And so, yeah, that exit, there's a outlet mall there and some other things.
I mean, and it's a little, it's not like you're...
Actually, McMinniman's is the biggest draw in Troutdale.
But you also don't have like Portland big city life there. It's a more rural community, wouldn't you say?
Yes,
a little bit?
I would say it's grown a lot. And now it's just kind of connects to Gresham, which kind of connects to Portland. So good thing you're not asking my age because it's a few decades or so.
But
when Yes. When I grew up, it was mostly berry fields. It was more rural, for sure, and smaller community.
And you're fairly close to the Columbia River, too.
Super. Well, actually, the Sandy River is right there. Mm. And so my dad was an avid fisherman. I spent any time I wanted to go fishing, I could go fishing. And my dad was well-known on the Sandy. He was out there a lot. He caught... We were spoiled little kids. We had no idea because literally it was like Forrest Gump with shrimp. We'd be like, Mom, is there salmon in this? Because that my dad caught so many salmon. He caught 35 for my wedding, which was fantastic.
So he was putting it in everything.
Oh, yes. It was everywhere. And we were so spoiled. We were like, oh, salmon again tonight. Good gravy.
So yeah, it's salmon, steelhead. They also still do, I think, a dipping smelt fishery where you can go net the smelt.
There's no more smelt running up the Sandy.
Oh, I thought there was.
That went a long time ago.
Oh.
I mean, when I was a kid, we were smelting. We had smelt nets. And, and actually, whole other story, I almost drowned that because I was down there helping my dad. And I love my dad. He's already passed, so I can say this. He wasn't paying attention. He was just smelting, and I fell in, and I had all my boots. And luckily, my mom was paying attention and came and
fished
you out.
Drugged
me out. Yeah, technically fished me out. And I was like, hey, I think that was a problem because I literally remember going down for like the third time with water and light. Man. It was a little scary.
That is scary.
I was a little kid, but anyway, we grew up on the Sandy. It was great. Lots of fishing, and it was a big part of my dad's life.
Well, the fact that you have the word smelting in your vocabulary, I think automatically qualifies you to be on this show. So, because a lot of people wouldn't know that one.
It was great when we were kids because the smelt were kind of small. So I shouldn't even say this, but I wasn't very nice to some smelt.
A little hard on the smelt.
We made them. Well, because they'd be in buckets and just, you know, flopping around, and you didn't. Like when my dad would catch a salmon, or if I was with him, and you would eventually conk the salmon over the head to kill it. Mm-hmm. But the smelt, I guess, fairly inhumane. We just stick them in buckets till they died.
Well, they're typically a bait fish, right? You're going to use it for bait for something. Most people didn't eat them.
A lot of people ate smelt.
Really pickle them or something?
Yeah,
or
smoke them.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, but generally most people are using them for bait.
They're cute little small fish.
Yeah. But when you're a kid, like I'm not going to hold it against you. At our wedding, because I'm a fish and wildlife major, I wanted to have fish at each table.
Oh.
So we got these fish in our wedding. This was 20 years ago. The fish were like, everything was pink themed. So my wife ordered these pink fish and we had like two at each table. And the kids were taking them and putting them in 2-liter bottles with like apple juice and champagne and all kinds. I felt bad for these little fish, but maybe a few of them survived.
And you're a kid. It's like, who didn't take a magnifying glass to an ant?
Right. I mean,
these
exactly.
are just the rites of passage.
So other aspects of your childhood, was your dad a hunter?
No, my dad did not hunt.
Did you guys get out and hike or?
We were hikers. We just spent a lot of time outdoors. Mm. We weren't big campers at all either. So my mom was an avid gardener and my dad, we did grow up on the Sandy, so really fortunate there, and just spent tons of time outside.
So you had the river like in your backyard basically?
Yeah, literally in my backyard.
Wow. So yeah, I mean, that's, what more do you want than that?
It was very nice.
You go skip some rocks, catch a fish, go for
swimming,
a swim.
Lots of swimming when we were kids.
That's a great way to grow
up. That was
our
entertainment.
Yeah. So that leads us into fast forwarding to now a few years.
Yep.
And all of a sudden you're a mountain climber. So it's, number one, in adulthood, have you always been a hiker? Have you kind of kept up with any of those things? Or was it all of a sudden, I'm going to climb a mountain?
Well, going back to childhood, I did actually also have a horse. So I was a 4-H'er.
Oh,
so
okay.
I guess that's kind of outdoors, but different. So we would do trail riding and camping with our horses and take them different places. But we weren't campers in the way that people are campers now. They're like, it's Friday, I'm packed up and I'm going to a campground or I'm doing whatever. That we didn't do that a lot, but we did do certain trips with the horses, and we went and we showed them and things along those lines. So I think that might have pulled that thread forward to being an adult. And so I just like being active and being outdoors. And I am more of an avid skier in the winter. And then in the summer, I like to garden and hike and just do something.
Now, is your husband into these same activities or? Not as much.
Not as much.
No.
Not as much.
Yeah.
He did try snowboarding until he hurt himself doing it.
It's pretty standard.
Like, tapped out. Yeah. I will say I tried snowboarding once and because your feet are locked in. So I'm going to be a two-plank wanker for the rest of my life because that's what snowboarders call us here.
Yeah, that's funny.
And I hit the ground so hard, I kind of went black a little bit, and I was like, okay, that's enough of that. Because you only have your hands to brace yourself.
Oh, yeah. No, I did the same thing, snowboarding. I do think they have better bindings now where you can break loose.
Kind of step out, maybe.
Yeah. Because, the old school ones, you were stuck to that board. And so when you'd catch an edge,
you were
hitting hard. Yeah.
I was like, I saw a little Tweety bird. I'm out.
I'm sticking with the skis.
Sticking with the skis. I'm going to go down and change out of this snowboard into my skis. Yeah.
Well, I think also in a marriage, it's good to have activities that you can do away from each other.
Absolutely.
Like my wife is not into outdoor stuff too much. I mean, she'll hike. We're not a real big camping family necessarily. I mean, we would rather go to a hotel somewhere probably, with the kids. And so kind of the outdoor is an escape for me generally. But when we were first newlyweds and I would go fishing. She would sit there in a lawn chair and read a book, you know, while I was trying to catch fish,
yeah,
you know. But now with the kids, it's like, oh, you go do your thing and I'll go do my thing.
I'll do my thing, yeah. I've camped with my husband a couple times, but I'm an overpacker, so he just rolls his eyes and gets a little frustrated eventually. He's like, you're not going to need that.
Yeah.
Like, well, just in case.
Right. You're prepared. So
I am prepared.
I do think I've only met your husband maybe once at some dinner or something, and I recognized him from playing City League basketball. So I think I played City League basketball with him at Timber Hill in Corvallis, maybe.
No.
Are you sure?
He hates basketball.
He never played?
He played football and he got a scholarship.
But he never played City League ball?
No. Okay. He doesn't like basketball.
Must be a different guy.
He was always, he's bigger. He's like 6'2" and a half and played football, was always on the line or doing something.
I was convinced that's where I saw him from.
No. He doesn't. He's too slow.
I'm slow too.
He just was like, I'm never going to get to the other floor in time.
Okay. So, I've been curious about that for years. I was like, is that the guy I used to play ball with?
Nope. That's not him. Because even though he's tall, and I've known my husband since high school, and everybody was like, you're tall enough to play. And he's like, I don't want to play.
Yeah.
Football and baseball was his sports. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's fast forward to when you first decided to climb Kilimanjaro. So what was your inspiration behind, did you lead up to it by climbing other things and you were like, okay, I'm ready to do something big? Or was it just like you looked at a map one day and you're like, yep, I'm going to Africa?
Well, I'm a bit more, usually I'm so planned. I'm a very planned individual. I don't want to say OCD, but I do like things a certain way. And so one of the things that I really wanted to do, or my mom really wanted to do, but we weren't able to do before she passed, is she really wanted to go on a safari. That was one on her bucket list. My husband, who does like to travel, that would be a thing that we would, that's common ground for us. And we do a lot of, he wanted nothing to do with Africa. He's like, nope, not a continent I want to see. That's not my thing. And so my girlfriend reached out to me and was like, hey, I have a big milestone birthday. She's 5 years younger than me. She's like, I'm turning, I won't say the age.
X. 21 again.
Yes, 21. And you're going to be 5 years older and turning 26. Mm-hmm. So, hey, I was thinking about going on a safari. And she's been so many different places in the world. She's very, very adventurous. And I said, oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I totally want to do that. We were arranging it, so it was going to be over my mom's birthday and just kind of a nod to my mom and bringing that forward, a little bit of history of like, she would want me to do that. And so I was talking to my friend Carrie, and when we were planning the trip, I think she suggested it. She's like, hey, would you want to climb Mount Kilimanjaro while we're there? And I was like, sure. What the heck? Why not? I said, is it really hard? Are we going to die? And she said, no, I don't think so. So I started to research it a little bit. And the coolest thing about Kilimanjaro is it's not technical at all. Literally, you're just schlepping your way from the bottom to the top. And because I don't have any technical skills at all.
Yeah, you're not putting on crampons and climbing ropes and all that kind of stuff.
No, there's no ropes. There's no technical components to it. And so it seemed accessible, if you will. And I thought, okay, well, if we're going that far and we're already to be there for the safari, let's just attach Kilimanjaro to the front of it. I really wanted to do the hiking part first, the trekking part first, and then have the safari kind of be the cherry on top, something to look forward to. Mm. So as I was schlepping and thinking to myself, why again did I do this?
Yeah.
What has gotten into me? So I said, okay, yeah, sure, let's do it. I think it'll be fun and it's a good adventure. And I do like goals. I like to be challenged. I like to put myself into situations where, I'm not going to say that I'm unsure of myself, just more like, can I do this? This is going to be
yourself.
A good challenge. I want to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I want to just experience something that I haven't experienced, and can I do it? And appreciate different parts of the world, different cultures, different scenery, just different.
Yeah, that's, I mean, those are all good reasons to do it in my mind.
Yeah. So that's what we did.
Did you train beforehand? Were you like doing some smaller hikes and
yeah,
doing?
Yeah, I did. Well, I had to get in better shape because I was like, rut-row, there's no one going to be carrying me. There's right. no escalator. Where's the escalator?
Yeah.
excuse me, could you please direct me to the elevator?
Is there a helicopter yes. nearby?
Yeah. Who's going to carry me? So I did drop like 15 lbs. I probably needed to drop more and did start to do some additional extra workouts and going onto the Stairmaster at the gym with a heavy mm-hmm. pack on.
Oh, wow.
I did climb St. Helens just as a precursor to see, is this possible? Can I do it?
Or that if you even liked it.
Yeah. I guess the fun part is it's you, nature, that's it. Mm-hmm. It's you and nature. And you're as you're climbing and trekking and picking your route, you're really kind of just, you're in the moment and you're very like, everything's kind of clear. You're just present. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's the only way I could really explain it.
And for someone like you, that's getting pulled in so many directions and so busy, for me, I mean, not that I'm trying to speak for you, but I'm just saying like in my mind, you're, when you do something like that, it takes you out of that normal to where you're focused on survival and climbing, and probably some of that other noise that's normally in your life is gone.
Oh, absolutely. Because in Kilimanjaro, when I landed, well, turns out Kenya and Tanzania are not on the Verizon plan.
Mm.
So if you
so no cell phone for you.
No cell phone. If you wanted to pay a fortune, then you could turn it on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I texted my husband really quickly that I had to actually call him because part of the story is my pack, which I, as you might imagine from my OCD perspective, I had packed very diligently with all my stuff got lost. So I had to talk to him a couple times just to say like, hey, I need your help to figure this out with where it might be. It's stuck somewhere. I need
it. So it's stuck en route.
Yes, it got stuck in New York.
Oh, no.
And then it finally caught up with me. But it wasn't, that was not the best part of the trip. It's, there were some tears shed just because when I got there, I had to first into Nairobi and thinking that it would, well, actually, when we landed, there was a little whiteboard that had travelers' names and it was like lost luggage and then my name was listed.
You were the only name on there?
No, there was a couple more, but yeah. I was like, I don't know what they're doing, but I know what I'm doing and I really, really, really need that big old pack has everything in it. And because I had very two different sets of things, if you will. So I had my pack that was going to Kilimanjaro, and then I had a piece of luggage, which was for the safari part, because it's totally different equipment. And
oh, yeah. Hiking
attire.
Boots. And,
yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Luckily, I was smart enough that I wore my hiking boots
in case.
On the trek, just in case. And, you know, part of that process is you really got to break them in so you don't get blisters or you're less inclined to get blisters. And so I had my safari luggage, but not my pack. And I would have swapped that, obviously, if I had control, but I didn't have any control. So in Nairobi, which we stayed one night before going to Arusha, you know, starting to pray, called my husband. I was like, hey, I need your help. Whatever you can do from your side. And then, so we were in contact like the first two or three days, just trying to figure out where my pack was. And then after that, I didn't talk to him. He was like, this sounds a little morbid. He's like, someone will call me.
Like, something happens.
Get a hold of me. Like, yeah. You'll
They'll
be
track
fine.
Me down.
Yeah. Yeah. There, I'm, you know, I this is what I do, but in my backpack, I always have like my buried in the bottom. It's kind of like the Paddington Bear kind of thing. Like, return this pack to this person. And this is who the pack belongs to. And this is me. And so if either go missing, you can figure it out.
Hey, that's smart. I don't do that.
This is before AirTags existed. Mm. I think AirTags would be very, very helpful. traveling now.
Yeah, I'm only, but what is an AirTag? I don't know.
Oh, it's from Apple, and you put it in there, and you link it up with your phone, so you can. I have AirTags on all my bags now, so I can track exactly where, because once you lose your luggage, it's a bummer.
This podcast was brought to you by AirTags.
No, I'm not plugging Apple, but I am saying the AirTag is useful now. And if I would have had it back in 2018 when I did Kilimanjaro, I would have been able to tell my husband exactly where that pack was, which was in Newark.
That is really cool.
And I like call them and just don't take no for an answer. Don't let them hang up on you and tell them to get my bag and get it on the next.
So well, did you get your bag before the hike?
No, oh. I had to buy stuff in Arusha, just basic.
Whatever basics. You could find.
Yes. And then the company that we were touring with allowed me to borrow some things, which I'm kind of a gerb phone. I didn't like that too much, but I was like, okay, what are you going to do?
It's also kind of an awkward situation.
It you're is. Like, you're stuck. So yeah. Yes, I am about to sleep in a sleeping bag that other people have slept in. I assume you dry cleaned it in Africa. I don't know. I can't question it because you just got to go with it. Like,
that's part of the adventure though.
I guess I'm going to freeze or I'm going to be in this creepy backpack that, or not backpack, but sleeping bag that other people have been in. So I had to just do the basics. And then eventually on the third day we were on our trek, because the interesting thing about Kilimanjaro is there's 5 unique climates on that trek. So the first day and a half, you're kind of in, well, you're essentially in the jungle. You're in a very wet, moist climate that's warm. So I didn't need any of my super heavy-duty outerwear until later in the trek. I would have loved my really, really nice mountain hardware. No plug there, but it was awesome. A sleeping bag, that would have been nice because I was cold the first couple of nights with their stuff. And so luckily on the third day, my bag came and I splurged and just paid for it for a guy to walk
to bring it where you're at.
Bring it to me. So a porter had to bring it to me. And then I was like, oh my gosh, thank the Lord. I'm so happy.
So what's the total duration of this trek?
So the total duration of the trek part was 8 days from start to finish.
And are you targeting a certain amount of miles every day or is it?
Yeah. Well, you go with a guide and a series of porters and you basically, there's different camps or gate. They're called gates. And there's actually 7 different routes to go up Kilimanjaro and all of the 7 except for 1 descend the same route. So everyone's kind of coming to the top of the mountain different ways. And we went on a mildly busy trek, although honestly, I didn't see a lot of people at all. And it's probably because we started trekking in late April, early May. So that was the beginning of the trekking season. And we were pretty early on. We were this tour group's first tour. And coincidentally, we were supposed to be with other people, my girlfriend and I. So it was going to be a group of us 2 and then another family, 4 or 5, but they had to drop out. So it was just her and I, which was nice that it was a bit of a smaller group. Nice and not so nice because eventually on the 5th day, you're like, hey, nice to see you again.
What are we going to talk about today?
We're having dinner together.
You're not pacing with each other, probably. So you're going at your own pace.
I was faster than she was.
And then you meet each other when you get to the spot.
Right. So you have to get to these particular gates each night. And the porters, they're just amazing people. This is what they do, obviously. And it's a good paying job, even though good paying for the 2 different types of environments and cultures is just crazy. I mean, well, they get paid by the tour company, but then you tip them out, of course, at the end. I paid my porters, they get paid on different types of jobs. So if they're just a porter, that's 1 rate. If they're, you pay your cook a different rate, you pay your sous chef or your cook helper a different, and then your guide and your guide's assistants, these are all at different rates. And I think the top tip for my guide, I tipped out at was like 125. It wasn't extreme for what they do. And the porters are carrying everything. On Kilimanjaro, they have to trek everything in. Our tent, their tent, all the cooking equipment for all of these people. So it was Carrie and I lose track, but it was at least 15 porters with us carrying everything. And they have to go trek to get water and boil the water. And that's it. And they're all sleeping in one giant tent. And then the two of us are in our tent.
I wasn't thinking about water. That's a whole another
thing. They would literally trek miles back down or miles back up to get water.
Because it's just not that easy to find.
It's not easy to find. And so they would actually go in front of us and set up camp. So we would wake up in the morning and we'd have breakfast. And then, of course, we would have to make sure our tent is ready to go. So all of our equipment had to be packed, but still in the tent. And then after breakfast, we would start trekking with our guide and the assistant guide. And then that's where Carrie and I, we had different paces. And so she would be with Moses and I would be with my guide. And Nestori was his name. And so we would literally be passed by all our porters, like maybe an hour, hour and a half into the trek. And we were hiking about, it depend on each gate, but around 4 to 6 miles every day. And they would just pass us and we'd be like, hey, and they would already be at the gate, the next gate or the next camp. It's kind of synonymous for the same word. And they would have everything set up. And that would be for lunch. If we had to stop for lunch, they would send a few people and meet us for lunch while the bigger group would keep going to set up for dinner and set up camp for the evening and feed us and keep us. And the food was good.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, was it cultural food, like,
to the area? Or they
catered? Okay, they catered to you guys a little bit?
Yeah, they did. It was, and actually, I felt really well fed. I would, you know, they're pushing you because part of acclimating is that you have to get enough sleep, you have to get enough water, and you have to get enough to eat. Mm-hmm. And if you stop eating, that will likely increase the probability of you not making it.
And so in that acclimating, are you talking about to the elevation?
Yes.
Because I was going to ask you about that. Like, is there a risk of elevation sickness and those types of things? So Kilimanjaro as well. Because what's your total elevation gain throughout the whole process?
The top is over 19,000 feet, 19,358, I want to say, give or take a few feet. So with acclimating, you're constantly acclimating, so you will ascend, you will always go higher than you sleep, and that allows you to acclimate. So depending upon where you are, when at times if we would get to camp, we would have to trek for another 30 to 40 minutes higher and then come back down to camp.
And do you stay there for like 15 minutes and then come back down, or you just have to get there?
You just have to go up and kind of hang out just for a moment or two. I mean, we usually stopped and looked at scenery or talked a little bit to our guides and they'd point out certain things and then we would just come down and that's where we would sleep. And then that's how you acclimate. You ascend and then you sleep lower than you have ascended, and that will help you. I also took acclimation or altitude pills.
Okay. Did you ever feel like the elevation was getting to you?
No. Luckily, I am fortunate that physically I don't have a problem with altitude. There were plenty of people for both Kilimanjaro and then when I did Everest, that people that I looked at and just physically sized up and said, holy smokes, you're like...
Not going to have trouble.
Not going to have trouble. You're physically much more in shape than I am. You're younger than me, the whole nine yards. And they would have problems. And the cool thing in Kilimanjaro, I didn't do this at Everest, but in Kilimanjaro, there's at each gate slash camp is a book where you would write your name. And that's how they kind of kept track of the trekkers, is you would write your name, your country, and your age. And I was one of the older people trekking for sure. Yet, one of the things that they say as you're trekking on Kilimanjaro is poli poli, which is slow. Mm. Just go slow. And so if you go too fast and you're pushing your body, again, the probability of you not being successful increases. So slow and steady kind of wins the race. Mm. And you don't want to ascend so quickly. But now, we did choose 8 days, which is one day slower than what you could do. And I know people that have done it in 6 days. But again, they had a lot more problems with altitude sickness than we did, just because they're pushing their body to.
Yeah, and why not take some time to stop and smell the roses a little bit? You know,
yeah,
I mean, you're probably only going to do that one time in your life.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, I'm imagining you're seeing all kinds of scenery on the way up.
Yes.
And are you bumping into wildlife too occasionally or not?
No,
generally?
There's not too much wildlife after you get past a certain elevation. There's some birds, but there's really cool fauna, and I just saw fantastic plants and trees, things that I've never seen and I will never see again.
Yeah.
And so I think that's cool to look at and just enjoy. And the scenery is so different, and the weather patterns move in at different times. So it'd be foggy and kind of misty, and then it would be sunny, and then it just would change. And then as you keep moving up in elevation, you're actually above the clouds, which is really cool to look down, and you're looking at all the different clouds and the formations. And so it's just kind of, you're just like zen. I don't know.
Did you ever have times where you're like, what am I doing? How did I get here? Did you have that mantra in your head ever where you're like, I don't know if I can keep doing this, or did you feel pretty ready?
Well, when my pack didn't arrive, that was really hard. I had to do a lot of self-talk, like, you're going to be okay.
You can do this.
You can do this. It's going to be fine. You're going to make do, and you're just going to MacGruber it, which I say MacGruber, not MacGyver, but for all those.
SNL.
SNL. Yeah. If you're not old enough, you're like, what is she talking about? But so I think at that point, there were some times earlier on. Later, I felt kind of fine. It was hard sometimes because it's so crazy. You will be climbing and climbing and climbing. You'll literally climb for several hours, and then you'll get to a point where you actually have to descend to climb again. And so there's these big valleys and peaks, and you just say to yourself, oh, okay. I have
to go down to go up again.
Yeah. This is really not working for me. Yeah. Can't we just build a sky bridge across this? And
Practical planner in you is like, this could be easier.
This could. Yeah. We could get some project. We could Six Sigma this or lean it out and make it much more efficient. And so a couple times, I think for Kilimanjaro, I was in pretty good shape. I was somewhat prepared, and I had read some articles, although I have to say that I stopped reading the articles because they just felt like hazing, where they were making it sound so horrible and so miserable that you wouldn't be able to look forward to it at all.
Yeah.
And so I didn't bring crampons. I brought micro spikes. Luckily, I was glad I did do that, particularly on the last evening, which is when you ascend to the summit. And, you just slow and steady wins the race, and just kind of enjoy your time. And to your point, you said, Sam, you're not going to do it again.
Yeah.
So, and I guess one thing that always stuck in my mind was like, okay, you're not going to quit. I'm kind of a competitive person, and I'm not really a quitter. And I'm just going to have to walk back down this. So I might as well just keep walking up.
That's impressive. To me, it was when you first shared it with our Rotary Club, I was just like, wow, she did that. That's just, I don't know. I found it to be an impressive feat. And I remember the other thing speaking of feet that you shared, was there was some toenail loss or something like that, where you like no matter what, because socks are going to shift around. And even if you got really good boots, you're going to have some toe issues.
Yes. And I do believe that anybody could do Kilimanjaro if they really want to. It's just mind over matter. It's put one foot in front of the other. And yes, on the way down. Now, that was a really, really hard day because the last kind of day and a half it's a very short day. So you're only trekking in the morning, afternoon for about, I'd say, maybe 4 hours. So you get to camp early. They feed you early because they want you to go to sleep early so that you can wake up at 10 and be ready to go at 11 p.m. so that's when you start ascending to the summit. Mm. And so we left camp around 11 o'clock. Unfortunately, my friend, she was having respiratory issues, so she had to stay at base camp right there. So it was me and David and Moses. And, David was carrying, here's the other issue. When you get that high, if you get into trouble, you could get into trouble really pretty quickly. Mm. So we had one canister of oxygen between the three of us. And if Carrie would have gone and they were already concerned about her from a respiratory perspective, if she would have been on the oxygen and I would have had an issue or Moses or David, Moses was the guide and David was the porter, we would have all been in trouble. So yeah. Carrie stayed back. And so he was, so the three of us went up and we started at 11. And luckily, we were able to get to the summit right at sunset at sunrise, which was fabulous.
Really
cool.
So
cool. And then fast forward. So that was super epic. And you can't stay up for very long because no
oxygen. Like 15 minutes?
15 minutes. And then you have to start coming down. Mm-hmm. And so you're trekking in the night. And luckily it was a full moon. And I was up there where the ice cap was still there. So the moon was reflecting and the weather I was really fortunate. I had really, really good weather the whole time. I think if the weather would have been rainy every single day, that would have probably wore me down a little bit. But mm-hmm. in this case, we had great weather and the moon was a full moon. It was beautiful. That was schlepping. And I did have music. I always take music on all of my trips. Mm. And
just download a bunch of stuff. And
I do. I know Apple Music probably wants me to lease my music, but I prefer to buy my music because
then it's yours.
It's mine. And then I can create whatever playlist I want to. And so just listening to music, we stopped a couple times. The last ascending up there, it is a long time. It literally was, from 11 p.m. up until I didn't get up there until about 6:30 in the morning, right around 6:37. And so, yes, so you're up there for about 15 minutes. You get to enjoy the awesomeness of the site, and then you are trekking down.
Take a photo and
you take lots of pictures. Yeah. And that's where I saw other people that had been up there before me that had had kind of some altitude sickness because there was some stuff. I'll just say, well, barf. So that's what happens when you're getting sick. You'll barf or you'll have a bloody nose and there's some telltale signs that you're not faring very well and you have to go down as quickly as possible.
I've experienced the bloody nose. So I worked for the Forest Service in Colorado and I was in Fort Collins. And it was, I want to say we started at like 9,000 feet and we were all young kids and we're like, let's go for a run. And so we're going to go for this run. And I just got there and it was going to go from 9,000 to 11,000. And I hadn't acclimated properly.
Right.
And I was in good shape then. I was fresh out of college and I was like, no big deal. And I start running and probably a quarter mile in, my nose starts bleeding. I'm starting to get lightheaded and I'm like, okay, I probably shouldn't do this. I should probably listen to my body.
Well, that's good. At least you're smart enough to do that.
I've always been good about listening, but.
Good. So, and then coming down, that was a really, really hard day because, I probably should have cinched up my boots tighter on the way down, but you are exhausted and you're a little, you're not totally there. You're there, but you're, I don't want to say you're impaired, but you're probably like 85% of yourself. You're not 100%. You're not as sharp as you would be, mm-hmm. you and I just sitting here.
Yeah.
And so I didn't do that. And yeah, I lost 4 toenails because that was actually a hell day because you come down and at 11, so I got back to base camp at 11 o'clock and then Moses, the guide, said, can you make it down to the next gate? And I said, oh, I think I can. And
that was your friend still there when
yeah,
you came down?
She yeah. was. And so they fed me. I changed my clothes because it's super cold. I had so much gear on. I had about 5 pairs of pants or more, different types of layers, you know, long underwear, just layer, layer.
How are you hiking with all it on? That's
you just keep
you just
going.
Get used to it.
You had like I had five coats on and all this stuff. It's so cold. So as you're coming down, you're getting hotter. And of course, it's in the middle of the night. You're on a, you know, you're at 19,000 feet. It's not exactly warm.
Yeah, I'm picturing you like Ralphie in Christmas Story, you know, where you can't even put your arms down, you know, and you're just,
I'm a Stay Puft Marshmallow.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like I'm guessing the layers were more sophisticated than that, but still.
I don't know. It's like mountain hardware, Columbia yeah. gear. And mm-hmm. so you're just trying to, but you're warm and comfortable on the way up, but on the way down, you know, the sun's up. It's now 8 a.m. You're getting warmer. So you're taking layers off as you're coming down. And then at 11 o'clock, when you get to base camp, you know, take off more layers. And then that was really, really hard because my feet and my knees, well, particularly my toes and my knees, I had to trek an additional, I didn't get to the next gate until about 8 p.m. that night. So that entire day I trekked a little over 15 miles. It was really, really, that was a really difficult day.
Yeah. And downhill is hard. I mean, downhill is hard on your joints, you know,
it's
like your knees and,
yeah.
you
know,
and like say the toes, no matter what.
Yeah, my little toes were not happy, and so I felt very hobbled as I was trying to come down, and it was, I just remember, finally, so there's me and Moses and Nestori there with me, and everybody else is forward to that next camp, and I understand why they wanted to go to the next camp is because that's the farthest distance for them to get water. So they didn't want to have to trek water back up the mountain. They wanted me to come down because it's really only me at that point they're waiting on. And so the half the porters were coming back up to try and, I don't know if they thought they were going to have to carry me or what. Like it's getting dark and she's still not here. And so we got to figure this out. Maybe we're going to have to just, there are some funny carts there with, they look like wheelbarrows, but they're longer. So if you did get into trouble, that's literally what you would be going down on the mountain is a wheelbarrow looking thing that's kind of flat.
Have a plan to get people down if they need to.
I can't imagine. It looked yeah. horrible. You would rather
be a bumpy ride.
Die on the spot. Yeah. Exactly. Like, no, thank you. My guts are going to be shaking yeah. all the way down this place.
Well, how many days do they give you to come down then generally?
So you come down from the summit, you get to base camp, you pause, and then you go to the next gate, and then you spend the night, you get up, and you're gone the next day.
You're all the way done.
All the way down. All the way down.
Because I know going up, it's more strategic as far as...
Right, for yeah. acclimation, mm-hmm. yeah. You come down in basically a day and a half. It's fast. So.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, that's quite a story. I'm sure there's a lot more we could go into and different little nuances. But so you come down this big mountain. And now your friend, I'm assuming, was able to feel better and come down as well.
She was fine. Yep.
Okay, good.
And then we went on a safari and that was awesome.
Yeah. So safari, are you looking for like the big 5 African, mm-hmm. you know, what is it? Elephant, rhino, water buffalo, lion. What's number 5?
Oh, okay. Hold on.
Zebra, maybe? Or giraffe? I don't know.
Oh, okay. Wait. I got to go through this. Lion. I should know this off the top of my head. Lion, rhino. Okay, I don't know what the last one is.
I know water buffalo.
Yes, I saw lots of those.
Lion.
I saw those.
Elephant.
Yep.
And then I want to say it's probably giraffe and rhino, I would think.
I think the giraffe isn't.
Isn't it a big deal?
Big five.
Yeah, I don't know what the other one is.
Is it a hippo?
Could be hippo. Hippo probably.
Yeah,
or zebra. I mean, are those too common?
There's tons of zebras and there's a lot of giraffes.
Okay.
So
anything in that.
Oh, I won't say it. I was like, don't eat at Jimmy John's because you know what he does.
He's a giraffe hunter.
Well, he just kills the big five for fun, for sport.
I don't, you know, I'm a hunter, but I haven't not really understood that.
Yeah, that's
for me.
I'm like,
it doesn't appeal to me.
As soon as I learned, I was like, I'm not ever eating at Jimmy John's again. Sorry, Jimmy John's.
Yeah. He's not listening. He's, not. He's got more money than we have to worry about.
Yes, he does.
But so the African safari.
Yes, super cool.
And you got to see all kinds of stuff.
Yes, got to see everything and all kinds of unique birds. Of course, all those animals, warthog, it's water buffalo.
And you got all your toes taped up, probably.
I got all my toes taped up.
Did you regret the flow of doing that? Because when you were first saying it, I was like going, because I knew about your toenails. So in my mind, I was going, man, I wonder if she wishes she would have done the safari first, just so she wasn't so beat up.
Maybe.
Or was it like the reward to the punishment?
It was just my mental reward to saying, okay, you did it, you earned this. And I don't know. I'm kind of save your dessert for... Although I do eat dessert first a lot of times. I'm like, life's short. Yeah. It's just a reward. And so for me, it was the mental game of like, okay, if you get this done, then you can do that.
Yeah. It's a neat. And so this was 2018.
Yes.
Is that right?
2018.
Okay. So when you get back from that trip, is there anything that like carried forward for you as far as, and I was asking you this before, you know, in your daily life, as far as perseverance or the little stuff, or your husband leaves the socks on the couch and that's not going to bother you as much because of what you just went, you know, was some of that stuff that translated because, hey, I just did this really big thing. Did any of that happen for you?
I think what it did reinforce is that in the United States of America, we are so fortunate. We are so fortunate and we don't know. And I know it's only what we know, so we don't have perspective on other countries and what they have or they don't have. And in just getting to these different places, I saw such poverty.
Mm.
I saw people literally digging through garbage and just... not complaining, that very much accepting, like, this is the hand that I was dealt and I'm making the most of it.
Yeah.
So when I just feel like we need to, yes, we have issues as a country. I get that. We're very fortunate, though. And sometimes I think we lose sight of that in the whole grand scheme of things. And our poverty level compared to what I saw, it's...
You're fine.
Light years. It's just so different.
Yeah,
so
when we're complaining about the price of eggs and they're trying to find an egg and we have 15 varieties to pick from, you know, that type of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. We walk into a grocery store that's refrigerated. They're in open markets. It's just so different.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me... Yes, I bitch and moan. I'm like everybody.
Yeah.
I have my bad days. And
somebody's
like,
cutting you off in traffic or whatever.
Oh, yeah, you're going to get the bird.
Yeah.
No, kidding. not really.
Stacey's pretty nice, but yeah, we all have our moments.
We all have our moments. And so that helped me put it in perspective. Like, look, yes, we have issues, but they're not insurmountable.
Mm.
And I guess that goes back to it just reinforced, don't complain. Do something about it.
Yeah.
So how can you make a positive impact? And maybe it just sparked me to lean in a little bit more and do a little bit more wherever I could.
Yeah.
And and just the sheer beauty of being in nature with wild animals and thinking to myself, okay, I'm in there. This is their domain. Mm-hmm. So I've got to just observe and enjoy and watch and respect them.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the whole point of this show. We talk about is that connection to nature, where you come back to this place of really feeling who you were supposed to be, kind of, or right. it's hard to, and for me, there's a real spiritual element because I'm looking at it as it was a created, and just the little details that you can see, and it just opens me up to things that I can't experience anywhere else.
Right.
You know, even when you're in a hardship, you get stung by a bee or something doesn't go the right way. But the beauty, like you were saying, in the fauna, because a lot of people don't stop to appreciate that. But when you're in those moments, and that's the painting you have in front of you, I would imagine it just opens you up to being like, wow, this little bush has given me the inspiration to keep going or whatever,
right.
You know,
just so. To enjoy it.
Yeah.
Well, and be present too.
Mm-hmm.
No cell phone, no emails, no all the different things that life kind of brings forward, and you feel like it's a priority. And I've really got to sit. I do it all the time. I got to send this email out. It's got to. Mm-hmm. I have my 24-hour service level expectation of myself. Of just constantly pushing it forward. And in those moments when it's you and nature, let's just pause, breathe, and really just feel the energy. It's mm-hmm. like the connectedness to the universe, and you're part of something bigger, and respect it.
Yeah. I mean, that's huge to me. That you kind of hit the nail on the head with, you know, you go to Disneyland and you're watching the parade and everybody's got their phone taking an hour and a half video that they're never going to watch again. And just enjoying that moment, you know, right. when you're in a natural setting and your cell phone wasn't available, I mean, right. other than maybe for photos from time to time or right. whatever, I do feel like you appreciate it more. Like there's just, you're taking it in and there's not a distraction. You know, right. there's not a, I got to go do this after this, you know?
Right. Or I got to take a video that I'm going to put on Instagram or Facebook, yeah. whatever you're going to do. Because do people care? I don't know. Mm. Maybe you feel good about it. And you're like, hey, I observed this and I'm putting it out there that I want you to also observe this and enjoy it. But there's always the lens and filter that get a little bit disconnected when you're not present.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to translate that into, oh, I watched your video. It looked cool, but it wasn't the same as if I was there with you.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, we talked a lot about Kilimanjaro. I don't know how much time we got. Let me check here. No, honestly, it was great. I mean, I could have kept drilling you for questions, but I know we're on a schedule. And, I mean, what an experience. I mean, once in a lifetime, truly had to be, you know?
Yep.
What was there, before we move on, we're going to dive over to Everest real quick.
Mm-hmm.
But was there some cultural pieces that you also kind of got to immerse yourself either during the Kilimanjaro time or the safari time as far as foods or the people and how they treated you and things like that?
Yes. I think part of the adventure is also understanding different cultures and appreciating their history and their perspectives. And yes, everyone is so welcoming and so nice and friendly. And really, from an Africa perspective, one of the coolest things is it's just what you take for granted, but they don't have. So one of the things that I brought to Africa is, one, for the trek, I brought a frisbee. They'd never played frisbee. So one time at camp, I was teaching them, because we got in a little bit earlier, and I whipped out my frisbee and I was teaching them how to play frisbee. And it was fun because here's these adult men trying to learn how to play it. And it's kind of, is it play frisbee? I don't know, throw a frisbee, yeah. whatever technical term it is. So it's kind of, you have to flip the wrist, and that was fun. I brought a soccer ball for us all to play. Definitely they'd played soccer before. Mm. And, you know, I left those things with them just so that they could have that, and just culturally coming together on just the simple things in life. And also when we went on our safari, I brought pencils, and I brought some school supplies for kids mm-hmm. that I knew that just would not have the same kind of school supplies. So we stopped and gave those to kids, and that was really rewarding.
Yeah, that's really cool. The Frisbee thing, is just, that's. I'm glad you shared that story, because that's such a unique thing to... And something so simple, but then created a memory. They probably still have it to this day. Maybe. And they're like, this crazy lazy gave it to us, you know, like, you know, and they throw it around like this for some reason, you know.
Yeah, it was funny because they didn't have Frisbee. They were like, what is this thing?
And yeah, that's really cool.
It's like a saucer.
And who would have thought? You know, you wouldn't have thought anything of that when you were doing it. It was just like, oh, this would be something if I get bored or, you know.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to make sure that. Brought a little things from the United States to just kind of share and leave behind and supplement beyond compensating them for their time and their memory of the trek, but something a little bit more tangible. And these were easy things that didn't take up too much space and didn't weigh a ton.
That planner in you really came through. So it's a good thing that pack showed up.
Eventually, yes. Ugh.
So we're going to fast forward to Everest.
Yes.
So that five years later, so that was 2023?
Yep.
Okay. And I just found out about your Everest. I think we were at Crab Feed for Rotary and you were telling me about it. And I was like, and then I hit you up, I think, 3 or 4 more times to get you in here. But...
This will be the lowest rated podcast you've ever done, Sam.
I don't think so. The nice thing about someone like you that has that, I got to respond to someone in 24 hours, is when I ask you for something, now I know your secret, you shouldn't have let it out, is you felt obligated enough to respond to me. So now I know.
Oh no, I lost my superpower.
Yeah,
being used
your kryptonite is out there. But anyway, so 2023, the same friend talks you into doing Everest.
Yes, we were talking about Everest. And again, now it's 5 years later, different birthday milestone. Mm. And I like to keep pushing myself. It's a great way to try and say, okay, I'm not going to give up physically. I've got to keep making sure that I'm staying physically active and mentally active and pushing myself so that... Now it's making me sound like I'm a complete geriatric. I'm not that bad. But, you know.
She's definitely not.
It's just, I like to put goals out there and that like whips you back in shape, you know, because you creep up 5 years. Yeah, I'd picked up the 15 LBs or more. Probably like 20, good grief.
Well, but the climbing the mountain is a very tangible, like you can put a picture of that mountain on your fridge and you know it's coming, you know.
You do.
And Everest... I don't know Kilimanjaro, but I know Everest is not necessarily a cheap venture. So if you're going to do it, you got to do it, you know?
Yes. Well, it's incrementally, what I did to base camp is incrementally much less expensive than going from base camp ascending to the top of Everest. If you want to get to the very top, that endeavor is going to cost you $50,000 to $60,000.
Wow. Yeah,
mine
tons of money.
Was not.
You couldn't get Central Lamet to pick that up?
No.
The marketing guys would shoot that one down?
Yes. Yeah. Remember, Sam, we're a not-for-profit financial
cooperative. Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Correct.
Everything is returned back to our members in the form of great rates and fewer fees.
Yeah, I like it.
And fantastic service.
Thank you, so, Central Lamet.
Yes, thank you. And, you know, shout out to Central Lamet because that I have a great team that allows me to get away for a couple weeks because like if something horribly happened, they're completely competent. They can handle it. I have a very supportive board that was saying like, hey, these are your life goals. Go get them. We support
that
you.
That's really important.
That is important in an employer for sure, is to feel supported that way.
And I think it looks good for them. Hey, our CEO's climbed Kilimanjaro and Everest. I mean, that's kind of a big deal, I feel like.
I guess. So Everest is, I can't remember exactly how much I paid, but really the tour was maybe, it was probably $2,500. It wasn't
not bad.
It wasn't bad. Mm. In the whole grand scheme of things, really what.
For another once in a lifetime
adventure.
Experience.
Right. Yeah. And there you're staying in what they call tea houses. So on Kilimanjaro, I camped. And which is kind of ironic because I'm not a huge camper. But you stay in a tea house. A tea house is basically you get your own individual room. And
I'm picturing like an A-frame structure when you're saying it, but
well, it depends. They're typically a little bit bigger.
Okay.
And you get your room. Your room is, let's say, bunk. That's a pretty generous word for it. Basically plywood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you can put, that's where you're going to sleep at the night. And it is, it typically has a door and it can lock. Early on in my trek, I did have two tea houses with my own bathroom. Now, this is not Western standard bathroom, for the record.
Right.
This is like you go to the bathroom and then there's a big bucket of water where you're flushing that down.
Mm.
There's the water is not warm. It's not that kind of bathroom. And
so they weren't luxury accommodations.
No, there is no luxury accommodations on Everest, but you are in a house, if you will, and they don't heat, they only heat the central room, and that's where everybody congregates, and that's where you have your meals.
Mm.
And then when you're done, then you'll go back to your room that's not heated. So I would say I felt much colder on Everest than Kilimanjaro. It was just,
Elevation are you at there?
Well, Everest base camp is actually less than Kilimanjaro.
Mm.
By about, I don't know, a couple hundred feet. It's
not, it's not much.
Okay. It's not a ton. It's like Kilimanjaro is a little bit over 19 and Everest Base Camp is a little under 19 or right at 19. It just is a colder environment because you're in the Himalayas. Kilimanjaro, it's the tallest freestanding mountain in the world. Mm. And so you're, at the end of the day, you're still in Africa. It's a warmer climate.
Then
in Nepal, you're in the Himalayas. Like you are surrounded by mountains. It's just a colder, more alpine climate.
I watched the Everest movie to prepare for this podcast, so I saw how cold and windy it got for those
guys.
Well,
believe me, you know, I'm just a schlepper. Remember how we started the podcast. I have no technical skills, and I knew that was like death zone.
Mm.
That
you didn't want to be an ice cube on the mountain.
No, I did not. I didn't want to be pickled or preserved.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get out of there alive. I wanted to have a really good experience. And again, push myself, see what I could do, and enjoy the scenery and the culture and the environment and all that kind of stuff. It was, it's just really different. There's more people that trek Everest in general than Kilimanjaro. The success rate, surprisingly, on Everest is a little bit higher than Kilimanjaro. Mm. Kilimanjaro runs around 50%, and Everest, at least a base camp, is around 65%, and there's just more people on Everest because there was seven routes up on Kilimanjaro, but on Everest, there's only really one route up and down.
So a lot more traffic.
Lots of traffic. And keep in mind, there is multiple towns between where you start and the top. So there are people ascending and descending, and that trail has donkeys that are taking fuel and food up and then bringing things back down empty, and same with ox.
Hmm.
Lots of ox coming up. And ox are actually way smarter and better with peripheral vision than donkeys.
Oh.
When a donkey train is coming on the trail, that is,
Steer clear.
But the trail is still the trail. It's not really big.
Yeah.
So you would just get on the inside and,
cause those donkeys just knock you over. Basically.
They would.
Yeah.
They're dumb and they don't see you, and they're packed down. So they don't know how
they
wide
stop
they are.
Quickly, probably. Or,
no, they're just plodding along. And so really you would get your trekking pole out as to just like, if you had to push that donkey off of you, you would poke it and move it over.
These are the things you don't hear on the documentaries. You know, people don't talk about this stuff, you know.
They probably make it look much more glamorous. And, oh, by the way, with one route up and down and all those animals coming up and down, you're walking through some stuff.
Yeah. The old Forrest Gump kind of, it happens. You're
it gonna happens.
Walk through it.
Yeah. There is some stuff. Yes. So you just, I guess, I mean, you kind of watch, you have to watch where you're putting your feet anyway. So you're just watching that you're not putting your feet in a bad spot with a big pile at the same time.
So do you start somewhere else and then work your way up to base camp? Or are you hiking from base camp to other places?
Oh, no, base camp is pretty much the pinnacle. That's like that was another 8-day trek. And then at the end of base camp, then you trek up. Now, some people, and it's a choice, but I'm glad I chose not to do this. I ran into people coming off the mountain that had gone all the way to base camp and then were walking back down. That is a choice that you can do, is to walk the route back out. And I took a helicopter and I was so happy
on the way
down. That. Yeah.
And that probably saved your toenails.
Yes, it did. Yeah. And my sanity, because for whatever reason with Everest, maybe because I was so cold, I was done. That last night when I got to base camp and I came down and I got to my tea house, which that trek from the tea house to base camp, that's about 3 hours one way, and you go in and out same day. For whatever reason, I could stay at base camp at Everest longer than I could stay at Kilimanjaro, maybe because there wasn't such an urgency to get me all the way down to the other gate.
Get you to the water.
Yeah, get the water.
Just melt.
But there
ice.
Wasn't any running water at the last tea house. That was on the last night. I had my little toothbrush and I saw a guy brushing his teeth and I said, "Oh, where's the water?" He's like, "There's no running water anymore." I was like, "Oh, okay. All right, I'll use my water." out of my platypus and just use it that way. And so that was, I was done for whatever reason. It just, that one kind of wiped me out a little bit more.
Well, and the cold can really just zap.
It zaps me.
Yeah, it just takes the, being cold is miserable. And I'm guessing you had good gear. It just, no matter
really
what.
Really good gear. It was just really, really cold up there.
Did you learn a lot from your previous hike to this one to help better prepare you for what to bring and what not to bring? Or was it such a totally different thing?
A little bit, yes. So, but I did do research. I didn't have to bring micro spikes. There wasn't a lot of shale on Everest. The trek or the trail is, there are some boulderous areas where you're doing some climbing, but it's mostly just, I don't know. I'm sorry. I wasn't paying attention in geology.
No, you're totally fine.
At the University of Oregon. There.
Yeah. And it's 5:30. I'm just double checking because I know you needed to, but I'm just letting you know. So,
okay.
You know, because you got to get
that.
To this other meeting.
I got to go to the other meeting.
I took geology past no pass at Oregon State because it wasn't in my major. And I was like, you know what? I just want to slack off. But then I like aced the first test. I'm like, this would have brought my GPA up. But yeah, it just never interested me.
Geology, and it was, an easier, relatively easier class than like a physics or a chemistry. I called it rocks for jocks because there was a lot of football players in there. And I was like, oh, if they can pass, I can pass. But I just can't remember all the different layers of it. But it's like you're on a mountain and it's big, it's bigger boulders and things along those lines. And in Everest, interestingly enough, the first 2 days are just brutal because they're all man-made stairs. So you are just climbing a ton of stairs. Kilimanjaro is a trail, and so it felt a little bit more gradual and
more organic.
Yes. But then I also so appreciated, like, someone had to build these stairs that I am trekking on.
Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
And I would think it's more maybe one note on the weather in Everest, like where Kilimanjaro, you talked about the variety and weather patterns. I would think Everest is more just kind of cold the whole time.
It is. It's more alpine for sure. So, and it gets increasingly sparser as you go up, but it is, again, to your point, pretty much the same. You're at the top of it's more mountainous and more at the top. So,
now, the people, I don't know anything about the Nepalese people, but I would say, like, just from documentaries and watching various programs, they just seem like such a warm-hearted people. And I know the people in Africa, it sounds like they were too, but did you feel that while you were there?
Yes, they're great and welcoming also. I think what was really interesting, and maybe it was just more noticeable, because when we spent a couple days in Kathmandu first, and because if I'm going that far, I really want to see and appreciate the other culture. And so Nepal is about 80% Hindu. Mm-hmm. And the next religion below that is Buddhist and then Muslim. And so, interestingly enough, in Kathmandu, it's very Hindu oriented. So lots of temples, which we got to tour, very cool. I mean, I was in a temple that was 600 AD. Like, just put that in perspective.
Yeah.
It's crazy, the history. And so, but as you're trekking and you're on Everest, that's more Buddhist. Mm. So that seemed interesting to me. And really, things like in Kathmandu, we were looking around, we were touring, and just they also, Hindu religion, they cremate their dead. So we, morbidly, I suppose, but again, cultural kind of acclimation, understanding what their perspectives, their beliefs. And so we were watching people be cremated, and just, it was really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And a couple of days. And so then we took, you typically can fly from Kathmandu to, might mispronounce this, Ramshed. And so that's one town. And, but their airport at Ramshed, I'm probably mispronouncing that. Sorry if anybody's out there. And so we had to take a 5-hour ride. It was the most bumpy ride. I thought that I had been, my kidneys were going to bleed. And so we were 5 hours in there, trekking. And then from there, from that airport, we flew into Lukla. And, you know, my funny, interesting story on that, Lukla is one of the most dangerous airports in the world. It's one of the shortest runways at a high altitude. There's no go around. There's it's,
you got like one shot.
You get one shot, and it was crazy. So back to your point of a couple times where you thought, why am I doing this? But when you get onto this little tiny commuter plane, the person is assigning you seats based upon weight with gear. And so lucky me, I got to sit right behind the cockpit. And so I guess we'll call our flight attendant. She comes up and she closes this little tiny curtain. I mean, it's like two pieces of paper sandwiched together. She's like, don't look into the cockpit. And I was thinking to myself, lady, I don't want to look in the cockpit. Yeah. I don't want to know. I have my little tiny window that I'm looking at. And I have it recorded on my phone, because all I could hear the entire time was the warning in the cockpit saying, terrain, pull up, the entire time that we are flying from this one into Lukla. And so when we landed in Lukla, you know how sometimes you're on a commercial flight and people clap for whatever reason, like the pilot, we landed.
Nice landing.
Yeah. Or where it gets there. a little bumpy and people are just excited to be on the ground. So I started clapping, and everybody started clapping. And then later on in the evening, my girlfriend was like, who was the Yahoo that started clapping? I was like, Carrie, that was me, because I was so thankful to be on the ground, even though we had just landed in one of the most dangerous airports in the world. I said, listen to this. Listen to how it just says the entire 25 minutes in the air, terrain, pull up. And I thought, oh, well, if I survive this, I can do Everest.
Yeah, how many people were on that flight?
There's only like 20 of us.
Yeah, that's not a high level of comfort when you have that coming from the cockpit.
No, you don't. I'm right there too. Yeah. And I thought,
that's why she was like, here, this. I'm putting up this paper towel.
Yes.
There's a sticky note over this beeping noise. Just ignore it.
But the pilots that fly in that area, it's amazing. I mean, all those mountains right there, and the weather conditions can change so quickly. And there's no, as I said, no go around. If you mess that up, you're in real dire consequences.
Wow. That alone is an adventure.
That just flying into there. Pretty darn scary.
Yeah.
And so then you land in Lukla and you start trekking up. And then from the last day in the morning, I climbed up to this high point in kind of a flat area. And that's when I took a helicopter out. And so myself, my porter, and my guide, and we all left and came back down to Lukla, and then from Lukla took another helicopter out, because I was supposed to take a little tiny small charter back to Kathmandu, but we were, the weather had moved in and it was low vis, and the options were I was going to stay another night. And I, as I said, I was just kind of done.
Ready.
So I called my husband and said, how do you feel about $250 on a visa? And he's like, why? What's happening? And I said, I can stay here another night or I can get off this mountain. I'm done. He's like, just spend the money.
Yeah. $250 seems well worth it.
It wasn't that much, but I just wanted, I was like, oh, I've already, out of, you know, just appreciation, I was like, I've already spent quite a bit of money. But I'm done.
Trying to be a good steward.
Good steward, good spouse, and say like, hey, before I drop $250 because I really, really want to.
Yeah. I'm just gonna I want to get off this mountain. Yeah.
I am done. Put a fork in me. Yeah. But it was really another great experience. And I think, you know, going back to the Africa question and Kilimanjaro, things that I took and my team, they kind of cracked up because I took a picture on the way up of these two men who were sitting on literally just a pile of rocks and they were breaking bigger rocks into smaller rocks to use for a building's foundation that was being built not very far away.
Yeah.
And so I took a picture to just say, like, my worst day is their best day.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I've stopped showing it to my team because they were like, okay, we get the point. Yeah. But they're like, only you would want to try and have a teachable moment. I'm like, look though, these guys' job is they sit on a big pile of rocks and make the big rocks smaller rocks. That's what they do with their bare hands. They don't have any heavy equipment like we do to just pour a foundation.
They probably do it with a smile on their face too.
You wave, you say hello, and they wave back, and they have a smile on their face, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah, we're spoiled.
We are, and we don't know. And I guess that's where you start to travel outside of the country, and you see it, and so it just brings perspective to be thankful. And we're fortunate, we're blessed, and just try and show an appreciation, and that's, I guess, kindness too. It just sparks, like, be kind, put good vibes out there. Try and make this place a better world and be a good human to someone else. Try to make their day, give them a smile.
Because it matters even if you think it doesn't. You know, I'm doing a deal with a guy right now, and he's just he's been through a lot in his life, and he has this just amazing personality. And my whole team that I've interacted with this guy keeps telling me how great, man, when you talk to him, it just brightens up your whole day.
Right, yeah.
I'm like, I want to be that guy.
Right.
I want to be that guy that brightens up people's day rather than the one that's like, oh, there's old Eeyore again. You know, like he pulled himself together to come back into the office.
Where's his tail? Exactly. It's still pinned on or buttoned on. Yeah. Don't be an energizer or an energy vampire. Don't just suck just filling the world with negativity.
Yeah.
I suppose we can all be negative here and there. However, what are you doing about it? That's my biggest bitch about it, or my pet peeve. Like, don't bitch, do something.
I like that. It's a good way to kind of close this out, but it's like, you know, how do we make the world a better place? I had another question.
Dip yourself back into the outdoors. That's how you do it. Just ground yourself back into.
It's huge.
Like before we had electricity, before we had all this just luxury items and the phone and everything, like, well, I too, I'll go crazy. Like, if I leave my phone at home, I'll probably actually just go back and get it during the day. I just can't handle it.
You're worried you're going to miss something.
So exactly.
But for you, I think there is some good in that you don't want to let someone else down. I think that's a little bit of your personality. You know, just based on knowing you, but, you know, also let yourself have a little break from it too. And I mean, those experiences for your overall health and longevity, I think are huge. I just came back to the last question. It's on my thing. Next adventure. Do you have another thing planned?
Yes.
Oh, you do?
Yes. You have to have goals in life. Mm-hmm. So, next year I'm going to do, Machu Picchu in Peru.
Okay.
So that's
another mountain climb though?
It's a trek. You can, there are, I guess some people are like, are you going to take the train up there? I guess there's a train, but no, I'll do it the old fashioned way. I'll walk. And okay. So it's about 12,000 feet. So it's another adventure.
It's no big deal for you. Not a seasoned mountain climber like you. It's going to be like, oh, Machu Picchu. I got this.
It is kind of crazy to be on an airplane and you know how you have the 10,000 feet and it's like the double ding, ding, ding. You can do whatever.
You can turn it on off all your stuff.
Stuff or whatever. Yeah. If you ever turned it off.
Yeah.
So I'm like, wow. Okay. It's kind of cool to say, okay, I've been higher than that. Yeah. Just, and everybody, I really honestly believe anybody can do anything as long as they set their mind to it and they're committed to it and they have enough perseverance.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you for taking the time. I know I've been bugging you for a while. I thought it was
really good. Thank you, Sam.
I enjoyed hearing you. Yeah. I appreciate that you appreciate me, but I also have a reason to bring you back.
Oh, what's that?
Machu Picchu.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, we got a reason to do this again.
We do. Yeah. And that should be fun too, because I'm going to like a cherry on the top is I want to do an Amazon cruise afterwards. I want to, because in Peru, there's a part of the Amazon right there. And that's been on my list too. I really just want to see it and understand that culture and everything around that. And that's like in each of these different areas, there's all these different types of religious and history and just opening up, broadening my perspective. And so, you know, obviously they're ruins, they're Incan ruins. And so what did they believe in? Why did they believe in and all that kind of stuff? So I'm super excited for that. And then translate that into the Amazon. I was like, oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, I like that you combine a couple of things because you got to think, like we said a couple of times, it's odds are you're not going back to those same places. I mean, you might. But
maybe.
It's highly unlikely. More than likely, you're going to find that next thing. And so soak it all in while you're there and just immerse yourself in the best experience you can make. So
you only have one life and there's a lot to see, so you better get going.
Time to get trekking.
Yep, get trekking.
Right. Well, thank you for being here again. It was my pleasure to spend some time with you. I appreciate that my persistence finally paid off.
It did.
So I got you in here.
Well, just for you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.